Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 22nd, 2011. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, Adam Drager, head brewer of the Yak and Yeti Brew Pub in Arvada, Colorado, joins us to talk about his transition from engineer to professional brewer and his weekly series of fruit beers with tips on adding fruit and other flavors to your own wheat beers. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is basicbrewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And we also have a show page at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on our Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show. We greatly appreciate your support. And there is now an Amazon.co.uk link on there, too. And we have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on the site, too. You can find our iPhone and Android apps on their respective stores. And we're on the BlackBerry podcast directory now, too. We've got some good email after last week's show talking about canning wort for yeast starters with a pressure cooker. I got this from Darnell Brauner, whom you've heard on this show before. Darnell says, I listened to the Canning Wort show and thought it was genius. Thank you, Darnell. I'll give the credit to Andy on that one. I'm actually canning 8 jars right now with a pressure cooker I borrowed from my mom. I used malt extract and went with a higher starting gravity. I make starters using a 2-liter flask, so by boiling 500 milliliters of water to sterilize the flask, and then adding the canned wort to cool it, it should hit 1030 to 1040. That's a good idea. My only suggestion is, what do you think about adding yeast nutrient mix to your canning wort? That way, when it's time to make a starter, you have one less thing to remember. Well, that's interesting. I've forwarded this question to Andy Sparks, who, of course, you heard last week. And he said this, you certainly can make a higher gravity wort and then dilute it down when you add your to your flask. Something I've started doing now that I have all this canned wort around is I pre-sterilize my 1 and 2 liter flasks in the pressure cooker. I place the 1 liter flasks in there with a stir bar in the bottom and a small square of foil loosely over the top. Andy says, I don't figure it takes long for the flask to hit 240, so I just leave it in for 10 minutes and then quick release the pressure. I carefully set the flask on the counter with tongs, and when cooled, I squeeze the foil to make a nice, firm seal. Now I have wort ready to go and flasks ready to go, too. The 2-liter flask needs to be laid down on its side, but it still works fine. I've also been sanitizing my stainless funnel and wrapping it in foil until needed. And he says, now that I did the 7-quart jars, I think I should make some pint jars next time. I ended up dumping out 0.5 quart because I only needed 400 milliliters to get a little bit of yeast started. The quart jars work great for 2-liter flasks and add about 800 milliliters, leaving behind the break material in the jar. I'm already down to 3 jars. I already need to make more. Who could have predicted that? Andy says, as for yeast nutrient, that was discussed and had been my plan, as I usually add a micro pinch to all my starters, but Dave Johnson suggested that he has found that it causes excessive darkening of the wort. After he said that, I remembered that in Blam, Brew Like a Monk, there is some discussion of using yeast nutrient to enhance the darkening of sugar syrups. That was enough for me. The truth is, all grain beer wort is chocked full of nutrients anyway. And he says, the fact that the wort will get to temperatures that you can never reach in a brew pot means the wort will already get darker than it would normally. That's good food for thought. I'd love to hear from others, too, who has canned wort with and without the yeast nutrient to see if there is a significant difference in the darkening. Jeff from St. Louis, Missouri writes in with this about the canning podcast. Your podcast on pressure canning wort started me on a trip through the internet. I've been canning wort since the mid-90s using a technique Dave Miller described in Brewing the World's Great Beers. I make 3 gallons of starter wort with DME and boil for 15 minutes. Then I ladle the wort into 12 one-quart mason jars, screw the lids and bands on loosely, and place the jars into 2 large stock pots. I fill the pots with water about 2/3 to 3/4 of the way up the necks of the jars and boil for 45 minutes, give or take a bit. Then I remove the jars, screw the lids down tightly, and let them cool before storing. I've now found that most internet sources say this method is not safe because the pH of the wort is too high and 212 degrees Fahrenheit or 100 degrees Celsius is too low to prevent the growth of botulism. However, I've never had a problem. I've even found a couple of 6-year-old jars in the back of a closet with their seals intact. Jeff says, now I have a couple of questions. Can I count on the lid of the wort jar popping up to alert me to the presence of botulism? Is my wort canned with this method safe to use if the lids and seals are intact? A good question. And again, I punted it to Andy, and he replied, the first time I was introduced to canning wort, it was with a technique that you describe, sometimes called the water bath method. My friend who just received Grand Master status in the BJCP has used the technique and has for years with no problem. But your research led you to the same conclusion as I did, that technically it is not enough. I've read that bulging cans is always a sign that something is wrong, but that the lack of a bulge is not proof that there is not a problem. Like I said, I know people that have done it that way for years and never had a problem. I would trust your instincts, and if it looks or smells funny, pitch it. And by pitch it, Andy means throw it out, not pitch yeast into it. That is a tricky question. You know, if you can do something and 99 times out of 100 you're safe, or even if it's 999 times out of 1,000 and you're safe, there is a risk that you're taking. It's up to you, essentially, to calculate those risks and make the decision of whether that risk is acceptable to you. Sort of like the show that we did a while back on brewing with propane in your garage. Lots of people do it all the time, and everything's fine. But if your number comes up, you know, for instance, if that tank, propane tank, fails, you know, the even though the risk was small that would happen, the results could be catastrophic. So anyway, you get to long story just to say, you get to measure the risks and take the choice of what you want to do. I'm getting good feedback from you guys on what brewing apps you use. If you use an app, whether it's mobile or desktop or both, shoot me a note to tell me what you use and what you think about it. And when we get enough responses, we'll put together a show on the topic. And I appreciate everybody who's written in so far. Good information. Okay, now you may remember an experiment earlier this year comparing flavoring extract to real fruit in blueberry wheat beers. And the home brewer who sent us those beers was Adam Drager. But now he's not a home brewer anymore. Adam has taken a turn on his career path and is brewing fruit wheat beers on a whole new scale. Well, Adam Drager, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Now, we talked to you earlier this year, and you had sent a couple of beers for an experiment, and they were both blueberry wheat beers, right?
That's correct.
One was with blueberry extract, and one was with real fruit. And we learned some things. Do you remember what we learned?
Yeah, the extract beer didn't have any color, and it had a very artificial, not a soapy flavor, but a chemical-type flavor to it that was very distinctive. and the real blueberries was subtle. It wasn't as acidic, but it had a real blueberry and like a blueberry pancake type flavor.
Mm-hmm. So you were able to apply that knowledge, and we will talk about that experience here in just a couple of minutes. But what were you doing for a living then, and what are you doing for a living now?
Well, I was actually living in Pella, Iowa, working for Pella Corporation as an engineer. And I was brewing on the weekends pretty almost every weekend, and so I didn't have any free weekends. And things were going shady with the housing industry, and my wife and I talked, and she's such a big supporter of everything that I want to do, that she encouraged me to look into Siebel. And so I quit my job, and I attended Siebel Institute of Brewing. And next thing you know, after graduation, we moved out to Colorado and started job hunting. And I applied to like 40, or at least I dropped off resumes to almost 40 different breweries because we have so many out here, at least in a driving range from where I wanted to live. And I landed a head brewer's job at the Yak and Yeti Brew Pub here in Arvada, Colorado, which is a close suburb of Denver.
That's amazing. That you, congratulations on picking such a supportive spouse, first of all.
Yeah, great.
Not everybody would make a leap of faith like that, especially in the, you know, the economy that we've got going on now.
I have a lot of jealous homebrewing club members from Iowa that are like, oh, I would have done that in a heartbeat if my wife had let me.
So did you, first of all, let's talk about your choice of Siebel Institute. What are the choices out there, and why did you pick Siebel?
Well, from my knowledge, what's available out there is UC Davis in California, which is a four-year university and probably extremely expensive. I didn't even look at the prices for that. Then there is a Siebel Institute of Brewing, which kind of has a three-tier program. They've got a seven-week program that's all based in Chicago, and they've recently, this year, they've converted it to online. So you can take their same seven-week program online over the course of like 9 months.
Wow.
And then there is the international program, which I did, which is you take half your course in Chicago, and then you get to go to Europe. And we lived in Munich for 5 weeks and do that. And then they've also added on a master's brewer's program that adds on to the international, which is another 8 weeks in Munich studying at the Domens Institute. And that's where we did our studies too.
Wow. So I guess you learned a lot about lagers.
Actually, you know what? We learned quite a bit about lagers, but a lot of our hands-on training was done with the wheat beers just because they ferment faster and they're a little bit more friendly to play with.
That makes sense.
And then the last type of schooling that I knew about, and I looked a little bit into this, is the American Institute of Brewing. And they have an online program that follows up with an internship at a real brewery for a few weeks.
So when you got out of school, how did you go? You went around dropping off resumes, but you said that there's also a resource that you get online.
There's actually quite a few nice resources out there. Siebel Institute themselves is a good resource. Keith Lemke is the vice president there, and he keeps an email list for any graduate of Siebel. And anytime he gets leads on jobs, he can pass those on to you. And he's just a good resource at the university for alumni. There's also theprobrewer.com. And they have a forum on there that lets you sign up, and they'll just automatically email you every time there's an opening for a brewer position, assistant brewer position, a cellarman, a bottling line. You can kind of specify what you're looking for. So that's kind of nice.
So what's the job market like in the brewing industry right now?
There are a lot of breweries that are popping up, but the ones that are popping up typically are by other home brewers or other people that have been in the industry, so they already know who they want to hire for the most part. The biggest bet for people have no professional experience that want to get into it is really expanding breweries and getting in on the bottom tier, like keg washing or bottling, and working your way up.
So what are the, proportionally, of the people that you've met through the brewing industry, proportionally, what are the numbers like of the people who have, you know, started from the ground up washing kegs and bottles and such as that, and people who have done what you've done and got a formal education first?
The people that are opening up the small nano breweries, their whole background is just home brewing, and they started up themselves. So it's kind of not even a factor. But I can't speak to the whole nation, but I've got a better feel for what the craft industry is like in Colorado now. And my sense is that at least 75% of them are working their way from the ground up.
Hmm.
They've lived their whole life in Colorado home brewing, and they've got their foot in the door at a brewery early on. For instance, one of the places I was interested in working for was Boulder Brewing Company, or Boulder Beer. They're the oldest surviving craft brewer out there, even older than Sierra Nevada, just by a few months. And so they've got a long reputation. And I talked to them about brewing, and I have a formal education now. And he says, "Well, you start on the bottling line like everybody else." He's like, I was pretty lucky. I was only on the bottling line for 2 years before I became a." And so, I regretted walking away from that, thinking, "Well, I had an in, but I really wanted to be doing brewing."
So your choice was essentially be a small fish in a big bowl, or a big fish in a little bowl, essentially, right?
That's correct.
So what's it like? I mean, stepping in, you're at the Yak and Yeti. What's it like stepping in as the big guy on your first day of work?
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about the previous brewer. His name is Chris Kennedy, and he actually got headhunted by a person we're familiar with, Jamil Zanishev. He's the new head brewer at the Heretic.
Awesome.
So he's pretty lucky guy too. And so I think he felt a little bit he felt good that he got that job, and maybe he gave me my break because of that too.
but you know, not much pressure in that job working for Jamil, right?
Right, right. He's one of, you know, the winningest home brewer.
So, but
no, I was actually not concerned about the brewing side of things. I was actually more concerned about, okay, what happens when my steam boiler breaks? I ran out of a chemical. Where do I get this? A fitting just broke. I was more concerned about, you know, some of the head brewers' jobs that maybe you don't think about it, but they still need to get done, because otherwise your brewery isn't running. And I found out that actually having an engineering background was fantastic, because I'm probably doing more engineering than I actually am doing brewing. There was so many. This is such an old building. The Yak and Yeti is an Indian Nepalese restaurant that's in a 1864 haunted Victorian mansion.
That's an interesting blend of cultures there.
Yeah, it's like it's a block away from Old Town, and I think it's the oldest building that's still left in Arvada. And it was originally served as the postmaster's house for the first, I don't know, few decades. But yeah, it's supposedly haunted, and our website has a link to a video clip where the owner had hired some paranormal investigators, AKA Ghostbusters, to set up some cameras and try to find some proof. So,
just don't cross the streams.
That's right.
little obscure movie reference there. From what you say, I mean, it is what I've heard as well, is that you're going to be doing a lot of work on the equipment because especially if you're working as a one man or a small crew, if it's got to be fixed, most of the time you're going to want to fix it because you don't want to call in outside folks. That costs money.
Well, I've been doing that a lot too. I get it as far as I can, and then I call outside plumbers or somebody to work on the glycol system. There was a leak in my boiler. I noticed it about 3 weeks ago, and I was able to get through like 2-3 brew sessions, but I knew it had to get fixed. So the first day that it started leaking, I started looking around and trying to find some people to give me some quotes on fixing it, and finally fixed it last week. So I'm happy about that.
Wow. So tell me about your lineup at the Yak and Yeti.
We've got a Namaste Pilsner, which I recently just won a third place medal for at the Colorado State Fair. So I'm pretty proud of that one.
Well, congratulations.
Chris had won a gold medal at the GABF for his Himalayan IPA, which is pretty cool to win an IPA because there's so many that are submitted in those categories. And so that's probably our number one seller. We've got Abominale, and that's a mild. And then another interesting one that probably puts us on the map is we have a milk stout that we flavor with chai spice.
Mm.
So we just call it chai stout. But, boy, that goes really good with the Nepalese food.
I bet.
So that's our small, but that's our standard lineup. And when I joined the Yak and Yeti, I talked to them about doing some small batches and trying to expand some of the beers that we have. So I added a haunted beer series that we serve in half pints. And these are stronger beers like barley wines. My double IPA is almost gone. And then I've got a Belgian triple and Grand Cru coming up as well.
Wow. You wrote me recently, in addition to all those beers, you've started a special series of beers that you're calling Wheat Wednesdays. Is that right?
I've kind of go back and forth. It's either Wheat Wednesdays or the Wednesday Wheat Beer Series. But yeah, so I had a little bit of experience with my wheat beers in the past, and I thought that blueberry experiment was quite fun. We also learned quite a bit in Germany about making Bavarian Hefeweizens and maximizing the banana flavors and clove flavors or learning how to minimize them. So I made up a full-size batch of a Bavarian Hefeweizen, but I deliberately subdued the banana and the clove because I knew I was going to be adding fruit infusions, and I would let those shine through.
So talk about, what are the tricks, first of all, of maximizing or minimizing that fruit, clovey, banana-y flavor that is characteristic of Hefeweizens?
Well, from memory, with Siebel, they hit you with probably 2 years' worth of content in about 12 weeks. So we know what we know, and we also know what we don't know. And then when we know it, we go look it up. So I don't have my manuals in front of me, but the esters, just about every variable will increase or decrease esters. So there's probably 10 things that you can do to increase esters. But specifically, I do remember this, specifically with Bavarian Hefeweizens, the number one thing for increasing the banana is to underpitch. If you underpitch your yeast, there's a lot of growth, and that pumps out a lot of esters.
Hmm.
So I deliberately overpitched and kept the temperature a little lower, and that minimized my esters.
So we're talking about wheat beers, fruited wheat beers, and I tweeted out there and put out there on Facebook that I was going to be talking to you and asked people if they had any questions about adding fruit to wheat beers, and I got some good responses, which is not a big surprise. First of all, Aaron from Twitter and Jamie from Facebook ask, when is the best time to add the fruit?
Well, I've added them in several different ways. I've added them in the mash. I've added them in the boil. I've added them in the primary, and I've added them in the secondary. And I guess I've added extract. So I think I've added fruit like five different ways. And hands down, my favorite way of adding it, and I think most of the literature will say this too, is put it in the secondary.
And is there a guideline on how much? I mean, or is it just per fruit? Different fruits have different flavor characteristics, and you just have to judge.
If you want to like be an expert at any one fruit, you do it through trial and error. But a good rule of thumb is a pound per gallon. And I've had pretty good luck with that. And then just, you know, 1 pound up or 1 pound down sometimes makes all the difference if you think it's just not fruity enough.
Steven asks, do you prefer extract flavors or fresh fruit? Do they prepare your own extract, if that's the case? How do you prepare the fresh fruit? And how much do they use per batch? And can we get a recipe?
Well, there's a lot of questions.
Well, first of all, I guess we can say that you prefer fresh fruit to extract, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's just doesn't take much experience of playing around to find out that fresh fruit gives you a real fruit flavor, and it seems pretty logical. Well, I can just talk you through, like, the first one that I released was a strawberry wheat beer, because strawberries were just coming out of season when I started this, and I wanted to grab those before I couldn't get them anymore. And so I'm actually, even though I'm a professional brewer, I find it really easy to get fruit in and out of Cornelius kegs. So for this series, I just bought a lot of hop socks, the muslin bags, and I would buy fresh fruit. And so I have a plastic pitcher, and I put the fruit in there, and I muddled it up. And so I just kind of squished it all up. I didn't even take off. It's too much work to take off the stems off strawberries, so I just left all the stems in there and everything.
Wow.
Muddled it up and poured it into the hop sacks and tied them off and just dropped them right into the bottom of the keg. And then I racked fresh wheat beer right on top of that and closed it off. Since I was serving my beers like a week after I was preparing them, I really had no concerns about bacteria. There's enough CO2, there's enough low pH, there's enough alcohol, there's enough factors, there's not enough food really, but there's enough factors in there to repress the bacteria at least for a week or two. I mean, if you're talking going 6 months, yeah, you'll probably get some lactobacillus and maybe pediococcus in there and all sorts of other stuff that's natural on the fruit. But you'll be fine if you just serve it a week or two later.
Yeah, now, if you are wanting to bottle, say if you're a home brewer and wanting to bottle the fruit wheat beer, Casey asks how to best sanitize the fruit. I mean, if you are going to be cautious about, you know, long-term storage and such as that, if you're not going to do what you're doing and just put it in a corny keg and serve it fresh, which sounds tasty, by the way, what would you recommend the best strategy to sanitize the fruit?
Well, there's always going to be trade-offs. So serving it, making it fresh and serving it fresh is going to be the best beer flavor you're going to get out of it, and any other thing that you want to do is you're going to have to have some trade-offs. So, for instance, if like I've bottled some, you know, fruit meads and fruit beers before, the blueberry experiment, for instance, and the easiest way that I've found, there might be some other ways out there, but I'll just add a little bit of water to the fruit and put it in a microwavable bowl and just boil it, and that'll kill everything. But then now you kind of got, you might get a little bit of a cooked flavor. It's just, I don't know, cold fresh fruit to me has a certain flavor to it. And once you warm up strawberries, you might get some other flavors going on.
So could you bring it up to, say, 160 degrees Fahrenheit or 170 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that, and hold it for a short period of time to kind of pasteurize it rather than bringing it all the way up to boiling?
Yeah, that might be better from, you know, releasing like the pectins and making it all mushy. It's still pasteurization, so yes, that would be good for killing the bugs.
Yeah, you talk about pectins. I mean, what's the impact if you do release pectins from heating the fruit? What kind of impact is that going to have on your beer?
The biggest one would be haze. I mean, there's a lot of fruit beers out there that are filtered, and they'll give you a crystal clear, you know, blonde ale, or American wheat beers are supposed to be filtered. But I deliberately went with the Hefeweizen because I didn't want to have to worry trying this many different fruits. I didn't want to pay attention to how much pectin's in each one. I kind of went the lazy route.
Well, Lamel says, what is the most exotic fruit you've used, and what should you never try to put in wheat beer?
Well, I can run you down the list that we did this summer already. Started out with strawberry, and that was a great opening week release. The cherry went over really, really well. I used sweet cherries opposed to tart Bing cherries. I did vanilla beans. I did blueberries, clove, cantaloupe, raspberries, chili peppers, blackberries, peaches. This week, my plum wheat comes out. And then since next week is the GABF here in Denver area, all the breweries have got crazy stuff going on from Monday all the way to Sunday. And so I bought 4 pounds of Hot Hearts or Red Hots. And I'm going to put those in the beer.
Wow. How did you treat the vanilla beans?
Vanilla beans are pretty easy to use. I like to use, in a 5-gallon keg, I always like to use 4 beans. And you just take a knife and you cut it all the way down the length of the bean. And then that kind of exposes the pulp on the inside of it. Because the beans are dried. And then I'll chop it up into small chunks. I don't know.
I guess
millimeters.
I've soaked vanilla beans in a little bit of bourbon. I don't know if bourbon would pair well with a Hefeweizen though.
you could use Everclear or some non. But I find that the flavor goes in them fine. You don't want those chunks in there, so you still got to, like the clove and the vanilla. You should put it in a very tightly knit bag, so you don't lose the chunks.
Sverner says, which are the best combination of fruits? For example, raspberries and peaches sound delicious to me. So I guess if you run out of if you run out of single fruits to put in your beer, you could run up the combinations.
Note to self. this went pretty good this year. You know, every trying to get people to come into the restaurant. You know, Wednesday was an okay business night, but it the business is definitely better on Wednesdays now that they have a new beer to come and check out it each week.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I mean, a weekly rotating beer like that's should generate some excitement. I wish I lived closer. That's the only thing.
The only one that I didn't get to that I kind of wanted to do was a watermelon wheat, which there's other commercial breweries that have done that one. But the only watermelon wheat that I've done before is I put it in the mash, and it was a disaster. Because it was cold, and I added it, and I couldn't hit my mash temperatures, and it was just a disaster. So if I do it again, I've learned my lesson. Just put it in the secondary or straight into the keg.
Well, here's a little sneak peek spoiler. Andy and I, or Steve and I, have brewed our Halloween beer this year, and so I'll tell you after we get done with this conversation our experience, and whether it'll be interesting to see if that will be a monster beer or a tame one. But there is watermelon involved.
Oh, nice.
Tom says, should you avoid adding fruit to a Dunkelweizen or a Weizenbock? If not, which fruits would go well with those styles?
Well, I just got done judging at a BJCP competition, and so I recently reread the guidelines again. And it's funny because Americans, we really like to go over the top on our hops, our alcohol, our fruit. And some of these, I like to go over the top. But for BJCP, they actually want you to pick a style of beer and a style of fruit that complements each other. And it's like right down the middle, 50-50. I can taste as much of the Dunkelweizen that I want to taste, and I can taste as much as, the cherry, if it's used. And you don't want either one to really overpower the other one.
So if you get, if you think of like a dark wheat beer, you might think of, dark bread notes. You might even get some little chocolatey flavors in it. So, I'm thinking cherries, first of all.
Actually, I made a 1 gallon batch of cherry Dunkelweizen, and it was pretty good before, not here at the Yak. But I think what I learned is, based on the style of beer, it has X amount of flavor potential, and I was trying to go maybe 1.5 times more, maybe 2 times more of that flavor threshold. I wasn't trying to go, wow, this is 4 times more powerful, and I'm drinking pure blueberry juice. but you have to keep that in mind. So the darker the beer you go, you have to find a stronger fruit. Or if you're going to use something very subtle like the peaches, like last week I used 5 pounds of peaches. It was the pound per gallon rule. It was very, very subtle. Mm. I mean, you could taste it if you thought peaches, but if you wanted to go like twice the threshold, you'd have to go 2 or 3 pounds per gallon.
Wow. And then you're not getting much beer out of your corny cake at that point. Yeah. It's mostly going to be fruit.
Yeah, I got a half pulp.
David asks, Nuglaris is mum on their recipes and process, but hint, think winemaking, which I think Dan Carey said on this show. Does Adam look to winemaking or adapt any techniques from it in his handling of fruit? So that would be more for the long-term storage or packaging, probably.
If I was to bottle this, I would definitely study that and look to that a little bit more. But no, I'm just going with a beer approach and just flavoring it in the secondary. I actually went to school at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville, which is less than an hour away from Nuglaris. So I drank a lot of that. That was Spotted Cow was my college beer of choice. And I really, really enjoyed the raspberry tart and the Belgian red that they have. But, back to the BJCP thing, that they're saying that wouldn't even count because you're almost drinking the juice that's fermented with beer yeast and carbonated to beer levels.
Well, I think I always compare those two beers, the raspberry tart and the Wisconsin Belgian red. I compare those to a cherry pie and a raspberry pie because it's, like you said, it's the fruit up front, but the beer is kind of like the crust of the pie in the background. And so it's unbalanced, but it's a nice unbalanced.
I still really enjoy them.
I just wonder, when he says look to winemaking, I just wonder if to get the sweetness that he gets out of those beers, I wonder if there's, some sort of, if he adds some sort of stabilizing agent like, potassium sorbate or something like that, and then back sweetens with the fruit. I don't,
If, something else that we learned in our classes is that once you run out of food, there's nothing else to eat. Or once the alcohol tolerance has been met, then the yeast falls dormant.
Mm-hmm.
So if you fully understand the yeast that you're using and the types of sugars that you have in there, you don't need to use potassium sorbate. It's the quick and dirty route. It's very simple and easy. But I'm not saying that he is or isn't using it, but based on his German background, I would be surprised if he is.
But those aren't really high alcohol beers, are they?
I can't remember. I think 6.
Yeah, so
maybe 7 at the top.
Darn you, Dan Carey.
they're I always classify them as a sweetened dessert lambic. They're not a true lambic, but it's kind of like a dessert beer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's definitely a dessert beer. It's not a drink while you're watching the football game beer. Or it might be.
Every time I'm done mowing the lawn, I always have myself a whole bottle.
The best kept lawn in town. So what's on your? I mean, now you got fruit combinations to look at, but what's on your dream list of things to put in the wheat beer?
I researched to figure out what fruits were going to be in season, and I also wanted to know, just moving out to Colorado, what is Colorado known for? And I was actually shocked, not just surprised. I was shocked to find out that Colorado is extremely known for their cantaloupe and their peaches.
Huh.
So it's not necessarily peach picking time in Georgia. It's peach picking time in Colorado too.
A Colorado peach. Maybe a combination of those two, the peach and the cantaloupe. That sounds pretty good.
The cantaloupe went over really well. I don't know if it's because Coloradans just love cantaloupe, but it was probably my fastest selling of all the beers was the cantaloupe. And I would have even thought to put that in there if I wouldn't have read that Colorado grows quite a few of them.
Now, on the pepper beer, what kind of heat did you get from that? Were you looking for a hot beer, or was it just kind of subtle to kind of tickle the tongue a little bit?
Actually, you'll have to look back at some of the basic brewing podcasts, because all the information I got on my adding chili peppers to beer I got from basic brewing. So I actually don't care for really hot beers, but I love the chili pepper flavor. So I took approximately 10 Wajillo peppers, and I just took a pair of scissors and cut them open and used the front of the scissors to scrape out the pith and the seeds. And I just used the meat of the dried pepper. And so there was like no heat whatsoever. Hmm. And I thought, I've done it before, and 10 was enough in a lager that I produced. So I thought it'd be enough in the wheat. But for whatever reason, it was still pretty subtle. I'll probably double the amount of peppers I use next year.
Huh. Well, I've got a pepper bush or pepper plant in my garden this year, and I'm sort of accidentally drying them because I've got more more peppers that I think it's a Serrano pepper. I've got more peppers than I can eat fresh, and so they're sitting on the kitchen counter and they're drying. So I see another episode of maybe homegrown pepper beer coming up in the future.
Neat. I was following the same formula for my making the keg up about a week before with the chili pepper, and I wonder if just because of they were dried and the pepper is just a different beast altogether, that if it just needed maybe a little bit more time to infuse the flavors in there too.
Quite possibly. I mean, and it's interesting to me how much the dried peppers plump back up.
Oh yeah, they get pretty pretty meaty.
It's wild. Pulpy. It's wild. The Lucifer or the not Lucifer, the Lazarus effect on the Well, this has been fun. Is there anything else that you can think of that you know your former homebrewing colleagues now that you're not a homebrewer anymore, is there anything else any words of wisdom that you can pass on?
Well, from what I've seen here in Colorado, I think the biggest route is, you know, in the best way to do it for the least amount of money is to get your foot in the door and kind of work your way from the ground up. So if you have a local brewery that'll let you volunteer on the Saturdays to help bottle or help clean kegs or that sort of thing, it's a lot about networking too. You know, I've met a lot of the head brewers out here now, and we've become, you know, professional friends or acquaintances, however you want to say. And it's really good because this industry is awesome. People will help you out in a heartbeat. I had a beer that the yeast wasn't taking off, and I called up a guy on the other side of town, and he let me drive over there and get some free yeast. So
wow. Yeah, then I hear that all the time, you know, that that people will, I mean, that's why you have a lot of collaboration beers out there, is because people, even the big boys, work together.
Yep, and when I don't know who to go to for my boiler because it breaks down, I've got several people to call, and I pick their brains, and I use a lot of their contacts that they've built because they've been in Colorado for a while, and I'm new to the city.
Well, excellent. Congratulations, Adam. I'm excited for you. I'm glad that you have kept in contact, and I hope that you'll come up with something interesting and exciting to talk about again.
Yeah, and what's kind of interesting too is next week is the GABF, and it was on my agenda since moving out here. I was going to go to the GABF no matter what, but I've never been there before. So the very first time I get to go to the GABF, I'm pouring my beers at a booth.
Well, that's awesome. I'm sorry that we're missing your debut this year, but maybe we'll see you next year.
All right, I look forward to that.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, James.
Well, thanks again to Adam. Awesome to hear that he is taking his brewing passion to the next level and is finding success and having fun at the same time. I'll post links to Adam's blog and the Yak and Yeti's Facebook page in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com, and I hope to hear from Adam again soon, and best of luck next week at the Great American Beer Festival. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please don't forget to send your brewing application feedback for our upcoming show on that. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online at our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Roadshow, Landscape with Drums, A Concert Tour by Motorcycle, and Victoria Old Fashioned Cast Iron Corn Grinder Nut and Grain Mill. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. And don't forget that you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. Do. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.